In 1967, a group that perhaps many of you are familiar with, known as the Beatles, made the following lyrics popular. The words from the song are as follows. There's nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy. All you need is love. All you need is love. All you need is love, love. Love is all you need. You've heard that song, I'm sure. You see, their suggestion in this song is that love is the answer to just about every situation in life. Love is a small word, and yet that one little word means so much in our language today. We use it all the time. If anything, we abuse the word. We love everything from baseball to strawberries. We talk about how we love our favorite soft drink or our hobby. We use it to describe our affection for a family member or a friend. We even use it to praise God. We talk about how we love God. And the truth is that we use the word love so much that I think what we tend to do is actually stretch it out of proportion so that we really begin to wonder, what do we mean when we use that word? What do we mean by the word love? Well, I'm not even sure perhaps that we think about what we mean by it because we do use it so many times and in so many different ways. But I want you to consider for just a moment, many of you may remember, I think it was the fifth grade or sixth grade, the first time I actually was exposed to one of these, but maybe you remember a thing called a prism. Prism is a little piece of glass, and when light enters the prism, it is refracted. It is broken up into its various colors. And I remember how we learned that. Do you remember? How you learn the basic colors that make up that light? Roy G. Biv. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. That was the way we were taught to memorize it. But what was so fascinating is that what you could not see, the sunlight coming through the school window as it entered that prism, when it exited the other side, suddenly you see all of these beautiful colors. Well, the same is true of love. That one word can be broken down into its various colors, if you will. The Greeks understood this. As a matter of fact, they had four words that they typically used for love. And I want to spend just a little bit of time, first of all, breaking it down, running it through our prism, if you will, so that we can understand that, and then I want us to come back and look at how God explains love. Look at it from the divine perspective. But first of all, when we think about love, there are four kinds of love that typically are mentioned in the Greek language. The first is what we typically call affection, or in the Greek it is storge. Storge love or affection is something that we all feel. It's the most natural of all of the loves. It has to do with affection that we have for others. And let me say, first of all, that the first three of these that we're going to examine are all natural. We're born with them. They are innate within us. And because we're human, we have these loves within us. But this is the love, affection is the love that typically exists between parents and children, or between children and parents. It's the love that we feel because we are with people that we like. You see, it's not something that we talk about often. Children don't generally talk about loving their parents. It's just a part of who we are. It's what we are in life. And it's a type of love that really requires a little effort. It's a gift from God. Then there's the second type of love. It is what we often refer to as friendship or phileo. You know the word Philadelphia, city of brotherly love? Comes from that. Philanthropy. All of these that have that phileo in the beginning have to do with this idea of love. And this love is just a little bit less natural than affection, but yet it is still natural nonetheless. Friendship is a love that's very important in our lives. If you look at the New King James translation of Proverbs chapter 18, verse 24, you find that they translate Solomon's words there as this: a man who has friends must himself be friendly. Sometimes we don't take the time to do that. And yet, what God would have us understand is that friendships require effort. If you want to have friends, you have to be a person to whom friends can be around. You have to demonstrate that you can be friendly. And friendship is that world, that love that two or more people generally have for each other, that is just the basis of the fact that either we have common interest or we enjoy things together, and so we are friends. We love going shopping together. We love the same places to eat. We love this. We love that. We love being around each other. It's a friendship. And if we look for friendship, if we strive to find it, sometimes it's hard to find. But if we just take our time and relax and just simply be the people we are, we find that friendship comes naturally for us. Friendship welcomes others, doesn't make claims. The third type of love is what we often refer to as romance. It's eros. Eros is probably the love that most people are talking about when they say something like, "I'm in love." And they smile when they say that. You see, it's the type of love that covers everything from the queasy stomachs and warm fuzzy feelings to the strong sensual passion. That's eros. That's romantic love. But in spite of what our society has done with this type of love, it too is natural. It's what God created within us, and it is a part of being human. But it's one of those loves that we often find that a husband or a wife feels for his or her spouse. However, because eros is such a powerful kind of love, it can sometimes become perverted in our lives. If we're not careful, we can become so wrapped up in our passions and our desires that we elevate those things to the top of our lives and we kind of knock God out of the place. And so our passions can become the center of our life if we're not careful. We let it control us. And so that's one of the loves we have to be careful with. The fourth type of love is one that you probably have heard mostly from pulpits. It's not something we generally hear people out in society talking about, but it is a love. It's one of the four. It's what we call unconditional love, or agape. Agape is that type of love. The first three, if you remember, I said come naturally. This one doesn't come naturally. It's one that we have to learn. And yet, without agape love, these other kinds of love that we have mentioned, they fall short. When agape love is taken out of the picture, what we find, folks, are broken lives and loneliness. This love is a gift from God, but it is a love that we have to diligently work at. Sometimes agape love has been described by another name. It is the term that we typically find in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, if you read from the King James translation of that passage. It is the word charity. And charity is a love that honors another person. Love that is selfless. It is something that does what is best for the other person. It is that which is not connected with our emotions. It's not connected with our passions. No, this type of love, charity, agape, is connected to our will. This type of love is the love that we demonstrate when we make a decision to love someone. Agape is the word that John used to describe God and also to describe the people that know God. In 1 John chapter 4, verse 8, he talks about those who know God, hearing his love, and he says, "For God is love." And he uses that word. God is agape. God is love. So, here's the thing. as we talk about this, this is the divine love that God stresses so often in our lives. What I want you to understand is that Jesus is the best model for this love. He is the perfect model. Because Jesus demonstrated this love throughout His life. He demonstrated it in His ministry. And He demonstrated it even on the cross. So I want you to look at this, and I want you to understand how we have this love in us and what it looks like when you try to paint a picture of it. First of all, agape love is completely impartial in its goodness. It doesn't pick and choose who it's going to care about. That's not agape love. It looks for those who don't generally look out for themselves. It is that love that sees what's needed and it acts upon it. It is the type of love that is generous. As a matter of fact, if you go to Acts chapter 10, and there you look at the conversion of Cornelius, if you drop down there toward about the middle of the chapter, specifically about verse 34, what you find is that when Peter is describing God, he says that he understands that He is one who does not show partiality. Because God is love, remember? So He's not partial in the way He responds to us. But secondly, as He begins to describe Jesus Christ in verse 38, He says that He is one who went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed of the devil. So here is this agape love in action. It is a love that is completely impartial in the way it is treating others, in its goodness that it demonstrates toward other people. It doesn't decide, I'm going to love you more because you have something to contribute to my life, or I'm going to love you less because there's nothing you can do for me. It is a love that says, I'm going to love you because you are a creation of God and you're worthy of love. That is agape. It's completely impartial. But not only is it completely impartial, this type of love is a love that forgives. It is a love that can take all kinds of garbage, as we might say, and then turn around and let it go. And I'll be honest, it's this aspect of love and agape that I constantly find myself working on. Because I don't think many of us do too well at taking a lot of garbage in our lives and letting it go. But yet that's what God calls us to do if we are going to love as He loves. It's the love which is the basis for the forgiveness of which Jesus spoke when Peter asked Him, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Till seven times? And of course Jesus says, no, not till seven times, but until 70 times seven. An unlimited number. It is the love that Jesus displays as He is being nailed to the cross. There in Luke 23, verse 34, when He says, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. It is a love that forgives. It is also a love that is self-giving. It lets go of self. It gives sacrificially. Folks, that's a sign of maturity. When we give sacrificially, not expecting anything in return, it's the type of love that does not ask, what's in it for me? It's the type of love instead that says, what can I do for you? What do you need? How can I help? It's a love that lies behind the command that we've spent 3 weeks looking at in Paul's letter to the Christians at Philippi. There in Philippians chapter 2, verse 4, where Paul says, do not merely look out for your own interest, but also for the interest of others. You see, behind that is agape love. Because if we truly love as we should, then we're going to be giving of ourselves. We're looking out for their interest. It is a love that takes the initiative in life. It doesn't wait for something to happen. It is active. It's seeking opportunities. In Luke chapter 15, Jesus tells three parables. He tells a parable of a lost sheep, of a lost coin, and of a lost son. And in the parable of the lost sheep, verses 4 through 7, what Jesus does is reveal God's love for those who are lost and the effort that God takes to try to call them or bring them home. Because Jesus talks about a shepherd who has 100 sheep, but one of them is missing. And he leaves the 99 not in a shelter, not in a sheepfold, but in the open pasture, in the place where there's danger. And he goes looking for the one that is lost. And when he calls it or when he finds it, he puts it on his shoulders and brings it home and rejoices. And what we need to understand is that God functions the same way. He looks for his lost sheep. That type of love takes the initiative. And it is a description of the purpose for why our Lord came to this earth. In Luke chapter 19, verse 10, what does Jesus say? He says, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost." He's taken the initiative. We didn't go seeking God. Folks, God came seeking us. He is the one that is the prime mover in all of this, if you will. But then also, agape love is to characterize all of life. On one occasion, Matthew records it for us in chapter 22 of his gospel. There's a lawyer who comes to Jesus, and he asked him, "What is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus responds, first of all, if you look at verse 37, with telling him that the greatest commandment is, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind." And then he comes back and he says, "On this hang all the law and the prophets." And in verse 39, he adds something else to it. He says, "The second is likened to it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." In both of those cases, the word that he uses there for love is that word from which we get agape. It's the verb form. It is that which is to be a part of our life. You see, agape love focuses upon God and upon our fellow man, our neighbor, and doing what is the right thing to do toward both of them. To love God with all of our heart, with all of our soul, with all of our mind, and to love our neighbors ourselves. So here is the question as we finish out the night. It's this: how do we learn to love in the agape style? How do we do that? As I said earlier, it doesn't come easy. It's got to be learned. You know, it's easy for us to be nice to our friends. It's easy for us to love our children. But that involves a little bit of prejudice anyway, doesn't it? I'm going to love my friends, and I'm going to love my children, and I'm going to love my grandchildren because they're mine. But we have to learn and practice agape love if we are to be complete. And yet, since it does not come natural to us, there's something that has to happen. And what we find is that it starts with God pouring it out generously into our lives through His Holy Spirit. In Romans chapter 5, verse 5, here's the way Paul puts it. He says, "The love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who was given to us." So here's where it begins. God gives it to us. God pours it out as for us as Christians into our hearts. But then we've got to work on developing it. We've got to grow in it. How do we do that? I think there are two ways I want to share with you tonight, and you may add some others to it that you may think of on your own. But one of those is we have to model Jesus. We have to watch Him and learn from Him and seek to become more like Him. He loved those who were unlovable, and He offered forgiveness to all. Many of us can quote John 3, verse 16, which talks about God so loving the world that He gave His only begotten Son, but verse 17 really needs to go along with that, because Jesus goes on to say to Nicodemus on that night, "For God sent not His Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through Him might be saved." God's purpose for sending His Son into the world was to save the world, not to condemn it, to save it. Why? Because God is love. And if you want to learn agape love, you have to learn that what Jesus came to do was not to condemn, but to offer forgiveness, to offer pardon, to offer a peace with God, to reconcile us back to God. And that's what he calls us to do as well. And how do we do that? How do we model Jesus? How do we become more like him? I love Hebrews chapter 12. After you read all of chapter 11, which talks about these different heroes of faith, you talk about Noah and Abraham and Moses, and you just go down through the list of those great heroes of faith. You come to chapter 12, and he begins with this: since we have so great a cloud of witnesses. My perception of that has always been this huge stadium. And those of us who are still upon this earth are the contestants. We're the runners on the field, if you will. And up in the stands, watching us as we're running the race of life, are all of these great heroes of faith who are cheering us on, who are telling us, in essence, you can do it. We've done it. God has helped us. But then there's something else he says in verse 2. Because sometimes the tendency is to get tired. Sometimes the tendency is to wear down. Sometimes we want to quit. We want to give up. We want to say the race is too hard. It's too long. It requires too much of me. And so that's why the writer puts in verse 2. Because he says, fixing our eyes upon Jesus. It is the idea that there at the finish line is the Son of God who is looking at us, and we're watching him. And what the writer wants us to understand is that Jesus serves as our example and our encourager. Because what he says is that for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. It wasn't something he enjoyed. He endured. And he despised the shame that went with it. But as a result of what he did, he is now set down at the right hand of the throne of God. And he adds this in verse 3. He says, for consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. You want to know how to love? Fix your eyes on Jesus. Watch him. Learn from him. But then also, act your way into a better way of feeling. Maybe some years ago you heard this little slogan: if you act enthusiastic, you'll be enthusiastic. Boy, am I enthusiastic. I used to hear that so much. But C.S. Lewis, who wrote a little book called The Four Loves, in which he describes these four loves, talks about the practice of agape love. And he says, if it isn't there, we just go ahead and do it anyway. And he described it this way. Many of you may remember when you were raising your children, especially when they were infants, when they were small, when they were babies, that in the middle of the night there would come a point in time where you would have to get up and you would either have to feed them or you'd have to change a diaper. Now, that bed was soft and warm, and that sleep sure felt good. But you got up and you fed that baby and you changed that baby, didn't you? And when you went in there to that room where that little infant was lying, crying its little heart out, you didn't look at that crib and you didn't say, why don't you shut up and let me go back to bed? No, you went in there, you picked that baby up and you said, oh, what's wrong, honey? I'm sorry, what do I need to do? You coddled that baby, you talked softly to that baby. Did you feel like doing it? No, but you did it. And as you did that, your love for your child grew, didn't it? Didn't it? You see, what he's saying is that sometimes we pretend the feelings are there, even if they aren't. Because as we do, and we get up, and we do what we need to do, as he says, the more you do the right thing, and even when you don't feel like it, the more you will feel it. The more you feel the love. So one thing we need to consider here is this. If we find ourselves in that moment where we are called upon to exercise agape love and we don't do it, what we do is build a wall. And eventually what this wall will do, if we continue to build it, is to cause us to not even like ourselves. Because you see, when we build walls, our relationships with others begin to crumble. But if we're going to establish, build, and strengthen relationships, we've got to break down the walls using agape love. There's a song that we used to sing when I was a teenager. It used to go like this: you can build a wall or you can build a bridge. It all depends on the love you give. If you build a wall, your world is small. But a bridge of love will conquer all. Folks, love is many things. But most of all, it's a gift from God. We were each born with the natural loves: affection, friendship, romance. But to make our love complete, what we need is this thing called agape love. And if agape love becomes the thread in our lives that binds these other three together, then what it does is it makes us a powerful witness for the truth about love. And in this way, it can truly be said of us that we are, as Jesus said in His Sermon on the Mount, we are the salt of the earth and we are the light of the world. And in this way, we can come to experience what Jesus called the abundant life. I want to leave you tonight with what Paul said about this. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, you've heard the chapter on love over and over again. But I want you to hear it from Paul's lips. I'm reading from the New American Standard, and we will finish with this. He said, "If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I'm nothing. If I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind and is not jealous, does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails." And at the end of the chapter, he writes these words: "Now abides faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love." God loved you enough to send His Son to die on your behalf. How much do you love Him? Do you love Him enough to be His child again? Do you love Him enough to put His Son on in baptism? Do you love Him enough to live the rest of your life honoring Him with the life He has given you? If you're not a child of God, if you haven't responded to His invitation for forgiveness and need to do so tonight, won't you come as together we stand and sing?